Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, welcome to ACR Conversations. My name is Nancy Flatters, president of ACR, and today my conversation is with Dana Casperson, an award-winning performance artist and conflict specialist. Welcome, Dana.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
I find it very interesting that you're a professional performing artist, as well as a conflict specialist. You work in conflict engagement, management, and resolution around challenging societal issues within the context of a public dialogue. How do you mesh the two aspects of your professional work into a flow within that conflict equation?
Well, over the last 5 years, I've been working on this project to develop these events that I call choreographic public dialogues, which are interactive public events that use physical action as an instrument to expand and to enable these public dialogues. And I've done three models to this point. The first one I did in Germany, which I've realized in four different cities, called Not on Not, on immigration. This one I originally did with my collaborated on it with my husband, William Forsyth, who's a choreographer. The second model I created in the U.S. with three groups of high school students on the topic of violence. And the main question those students came up with as we collaborated to create the physical model and the questions was, is there a difference between the physical punishment of children and violence? And then my current project is called Violence Recode. And this is a project that looks at structural violence like racism or sexism. And I created the initial version of this with college students at Linden State College in Vermont. And now the project has turned into an international series of dialogues. And I'm working with communities in different countries to adapt the project to the way that those violence systems occur in each of those communities.
So I want to know more about those three models, but you've mentioned that your husband is a choreographer and you mm-hmm. collaborated with him on one of the models. So mm-hmm. I take it that choreography people together in addressing and resolving challenges, are stories involved in that? How do you come up when you frame the models? How do you come to integrate really as you start thinking about it, what it is you want to do?
So each model that I've been working on has developed in a different way. With the first project that I did, I was actually still in school, still studying my master's degree with conflict studies, and my husband was at the time working on a project that was commissioned by a bank in Frankfurt that brought artists into social action, and he was thinking about the idea of a room with qualities. And we were thinking about, okay, what would it mean? Because the question of immigration was big even then in Germany. Now, of course, it's very big. And we were thinking about immigration as a choreographic event. It's how motion, placement, have the mobilization of culture, the mobilization of people, the overlap of cultures and people, and what that brings. It's both a physical event and, of course, a societal event. And one of the really useful things about choreographic thinking is that it makes things visible. And to choreograph is to organize ideas physically. So when we started working on that project, of course, immigration and any other important topic is hugely based on story because it's based on humans, and we live by stories. We build our understanding of the world and our understanding of each other and our capacity to move into different areas through story, through the way we understand our world and ourselves in it. So in Not on Not, which is the name of that first project, I was very interested in trying to figure out a way that I could use physicality to engender an exchange of story between people. So moving from the level, which is the typical level that conversations tend to be carried on these subjects in public, which is, you know, for example, headscarves should be banned. Headscarves should be allowed everywhere, which is a question in Germany that has to do with immigration. So that's a positional level, and that is something you can map physically. So that's one of the things we did. I made a model that is a triangle, and this is kind of loosely based on the continuum exercise that people often use to judge the sense of where people stand on issues. For example, on one end would be headscarves should be banned, and the other hand would be headscarves should be allowed everywhere. Where do you stand on that line? And what interested me in the past when I've encountered that simple line model is that everybody knows where they stand physically. They know where to go on the line. So a body is a way for us to access those sometimes more difficult to get hold of feelings about what we care about, what's important to us in our relationships with other people. So I made a triangle that was kind of based along that, and on either side of the triangle hangs a monitor, and sets of statements come up. So, for example, the first statements were there's position A, position B, and position C, and the statements were, my family is of German descent. B, my family is not of German descent. C, I'm of mixed background, half German. And then people were asked to divide themselves according to the statements that made the most sense to them. And then the second statement, for example, was, I feel German. I don't feel German. I have no response. And then half of the immigrants, in my experience, always go over to the German section. And then some of the Germans leave the German section. So the groups and their histories start to come out even in this positional part of the model. And their stories become visible to each other as we move from that beginning, which has to do more with position. It moves into values, where we learn, what we learn, what we care about, into more concrete issues that have to do with immigration. So that's a way. And then in that model, in Not on Not, after the triangle section, people move to tables. And there's 25 tables because there's 100 people per session of Not on Not. And this is a public, an open event, so anyone can come. And there's 4 people per table, and I moderate from the front. So at each table, there's a conversation going on that's being moderated with the same questions, the same allotment of time. So it's quite a condensed, taut, kind of choreographed conversation. And the focus of those conversations is, okay, why do you stand where you do on these issues? What experiences have you had that have led you to stand where you do? So that's how, in that first conversation, we elicited stories. And the second dialogue that I did, I had the opportunity to work with 30 high school students from 3 different schools. And a lot of what I really love about these projects is that I have the chance to encounter different groups from all over. So for the immigration group, I met with groups that ranged in age and cultural background to try to get a sense of what their understanding is of the issues. With these young people, I worked with them because the question that started out that project for me was, what is your definition of violence? Which I've discovered really, it varies radically from person to person, even in homogenous groups. So working with those young people to see what place violence plays in their life already, what their beliefs about it are, how those beliefs change over time, what they're connected to. They're connected to family, they're connected to loyalty, other background. And those stories that those young people were willing to share eventually shaped the model. So they didn't find their way into the model itself, because the goal of these models is to create an instrument that channels the desire to connect, essentially, even among people who maybe don't want to connect, but on some level they need to connect in order to move forward on the issue. So we created this model that used different physical actions like walking or there was also a sound element there, clapping and stamping, different ways of different simple arm gestures that would physically, were physical equivalents, so things that stood in for something else, that helps people wordlessly share their experience around or their beliefs around violence. And then we had in that dialogue, because the kids were actually much more flexible than I was, because I was saying, okay, we got to get some tables in there. You know, how are we going to do this? And they said, we don't need tables. People will walk. So we had, instead of having the tables for the conversation, we had this mobile home base that people would return to their group of four and answer one single question and then move back into the other models. And so the stories emerged in both areas of that dialogue. Now, in the project I'm doing now, story has a different place. Here we begin with story as a way to try to take these larger structures like racism or poverty or sexism that sometimes seem so hard to get hold of. There's so much in our cultural dialogue worldwide, but it's hard to talk about because they're so big. So my goal was to say, okay, how can we take these issues down to the level of individual experience? And I read this great quote one time from Paul Farmer, who said, I'm not sure if I have it exactly right, but he said, by what mechanisms do violent systems like racism or sexism become embodied in individual experience? And I was thinking about posture and how body position can also transmit a whole story, and how a story is what helps people connect to thinking differently about the situation or about issues. So I worked with a group of students at this college to say, okay, let's take, you know, these seven kinds of structural violence: racism, sexism, heterosexism, poverty, inequitable access to healthcare, and a couple others, and let's think of tiny scenarios. Like, for example, what is one place where heterosexism plays out in our society? And let's think about how we can describe it in a single body. So we were thinking, for example, for heterosexism, of marriage equality, the ability of people of the same sex to be married. And so we came up with a simple posture of sitting in a chair. And I had an artist friend of mine draw simple sketches. And then with each of those images came two statements that are like picture titles. And so the way it works in the project is that there's two long lines of chairs, and people are seated opposite each other, and behind each line is a monitor, a video monitor. And, for example, the first image comes up, and it's this figure seated in a chair. And people have been asked in advance to take on the posture that's being offered. And the invitation here is that we're all engaging in a choreographic action to make visible these systems. So everyone, for example, in that case, takes on this simple position of sitting in a chair. And then the first statement comes up, and it says, a man waiting for his wife. And people are asked, first of all, to feel what it feels like to sit in the posture, and then what it feels like to be in the posture with that title, so being that person. And then the title changes, and it says, a man waiting for his husband. And then for many of us, the feeling of that position changes, because there's so many tensions around that kind of a story, which still in our society is not seen as normal on some level in many corners, you know, in many areas of society. And so one thing that this does is it takes tiny stories and it brings it into the body of the participant. And by doing so, either gives a surprising kind of cognitive moment of cognitive dissonance around around the story and around the issues that, that make that story happen, or it helps a person simply to consider what it means to be in that position. For example, in many places, it's not possible for a man to sit waiting for his husband. So in that project, story functions as the driver and the motivator, but it's not the story. It's not overtly the story of the participants. Instead, the participants become part of the narrative, of a series of narratives. And then the dialogue becomes internal. And during this, so for example, we'll have six different postures, and then there, a sign comes up that says, please walk to the person opposite you. So here people come together in twos, and they have then tiny dialogues where I think a minute each to answer questions like, what is your, how do you identify yourself in terms of race? And what effect does that have on your life? What effect does your race have on your life? So we then do engage in these dialogues, but on a broader level, saying, how do these systems affect you? How are we all part of these systems? And my goal here is not to have some people in the room feel like, oh, God, you know, I'm part of the majority and the oppressors, but rather to say these systems engage all of us, and they engage us all negatively. And it's not only the people who are obviously negatively affected by these systems, but it's all of us. So how can we step back, and with the use of physicality, how can we step back enough that we can look at it and see the whole system as a changeable thing that we're part of, that we both are affected by and affect, and that our bodies, how we sit, how we stand, what is possible, what is not possible, what feels normal, what feels weird, and why, is greatly affected by us. So we affect these systems as just as much as they affect us. So the story has a lot of different position in these different versions.
So I'm visualizing as you're speaking the landscape that you're painting, and I'm wondering initially, before moving into really. You've got it choreographed, and then you're dealing with specific issues in a way that informs each of the models you've described, or different tools in doing the staging, as it were. Mm-hmm. But are people initially suspicious of the process? Are they reluctant to participate? Because it seems to me, I'm thinking of myself, initially I might have some natural reluctance to participate in choreographed movement, as it were. So how do you overcome what might be natural reluctance if you encounter it in or with a group of participants or an individual person?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I'm suspicious of it. You know, from the very beginning, I actually, for the first couple of years of my practice in conflict, I consciously kept my work in dance and theater separate from my work in conflict, because I was concerned of, I didn't want to end up with a watered-down version of either one, because I understand the power in each. But what happened to me over time is, not that I decided to try to integrate dance, but rather my awareness of the effectivity of physical models and physical choreographic structures kind of pushed me to try it out anyway. So what I do is, and of course people are at first nervous if they think there's any dance involved, which I completely understand. And the way that I approach these projects is I don't want there to be any sense on the person, the participant's part, that they're being asked to do something that they're going to look foolish doing or that they don't know how to do. But instead, so the choreographic thing is my responsibility to say, okay, what kind of a physical structure, a physical model here is going to make this dialogue more fruitful, more rich? And people, you know, sometimes it's a little, there's a little bit of kind of hesitance as they come into the room initially. Once I explain it and I say, okay, look, here's what's going to happen. You know, nothing weird is going to happen. We're just going to do these simple things. And here's why. People relax, and my experience is that they actually feel more comfortable moving initially because the movements are all very simple, like walking or clapping. It's very non-embarrassing movements, which is really important for me. And so people, what I find is that once they understand what's happening and if the model functions properly, then they start to enjoy it because they don't have to talk initially. And a lot of times people have even more fear of talking publicly. And so once they understand that they're going to simply move together in a room in a really, you know, it's not choreographed in the sense that it's not like a dance. The choreography is just talking about organization and structure. And within that, simple motion can be utilized to help exchange. So in this most recent one, I found that I have to explain even more because there is this element of people being asked to take on particular postures. And the postures themselves aren't embarrassing, but what I found through trying it out at a few different places is that people need to understand that they're choosing to be part of a choreographic action. So it's not that I want them to do what I want them to do, but rather they choose to engage in this investigation. And the tool for the investigation is physical posture. And once they understand it, then they're also freed a little bit up from trying to understand whether they're being put, whether they're being blamed or being put in a position where, oh my God, am I going to be the bad person in this particular scenario here? And it becomes, by having this physical thing that's on some level shared by everybody, it becomes a way for the group itself to look at these structures.
So it sounds as if it's really, as part of it and as part of the movement, is that it becomes a way to have a lived experience of the mm-hmm. other in the sense that the person is going to be on both sides of whatever the conflict is being examined or on each side of the equation.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly, yeah. That's the hope for that, is that it does create this kind of 3D version of the issue that's physically
experienced. And interesting then, yeah, because then a person then presumably through the movement and the positioning in the room mm-hmm. and the other elements about which you have spoken really then become more aware and able to integrate the difference under discussion from each perspective or from many perspectives.
Yeah, I think that seems to be what happens. And another thing that element, speaking of what helps people to be in the room and, you know, be comfortable, is that for the first time in this project, in Violence Recode, I used music. And so I have 25 live musicians who are in a circle around these two lines. It's being led by my collaborator Cliff Berrien, who's leading it live, and so he's conducting it according to what's happening in the room. And it has a heartbeat bass. So it's simultaneously this kind of lovely drive, but also very peaceful in a certain way. And it creates this atmosphere because, of course, people are thrust very quickly into this extremely artificial structure. But the music is a container that people say creates this sense of relaxation. and the sense of ease that otherwise would not be present. So, you know, of course, I've been working in theater for professionally for 35 years, and so I'm constantly working with music, and I'm accustomed to using language in counterpoint to music, and of course physicality and counterpoint to music, and so it was great to come back to where I've, you know, come in the back door, as they say, and realize, oh right, of course, music will help create this kind of entrainment, this rhythmical connection between people that makes it easier for people to exchange.
Now, you incorporate movement, you incorporate music. What about art or drawn forms of expression? Does that find a place in any of the models?
Well, I've been collaborating with Tommaso Carnetta, who's the director of the Academy of Visual Arts, for about 4 years. And I initially got in touch with him because I was trying to find a way to document the not-on-not process, and I wanted something that wasn't like a boring, you know, book that... And I wanted something that got to the vitality at the heart of the event without being too intrusive in terms of what people were saying, because a lot of the stuff is not something people would want broadcast in public. So we tried a couple different models over the years, and initially we had a video from the top of the tables, and we mapped the hands of the participants on the tables. Over time, I think we took a picture every 10 seconds, and then we drew the shape that was created by those hands, by the lines, if you drew a line between all of the hands, and how that changed over time in relationship to the questions and what people were talking about. So it has to do with how people engage with each other physically. And that created something interesting, which was we then took, some of the students took those shapes, cut them out into cardboard, and then rotated them up into a sculpture. So it became this really beautiful, expanding kind of breathing sculpture where you could see the tensions and the expansions between people as time went on in the sculptural model. We ended up throwing that out because it was too expensive to have video. But what we found, which I actually love even better, is we said, okay, well, what if the table itself was the place where traces were left? If we're talking about how what comes out of these events, what are the traces? So now in Berlin, we did the project in Berlin last year and tried for the first time. We covered the tables in a special kind of ink, and then we covered the ink and the table with paper. So you couldn't tell what was going on. The participants were not aware of what was happening. But while they were speaking with each other and gesturing with their hands and engaging at the tables, they were leaving traces in the ink. And so immediately after the events, we pull the paper off the table and then take another piece of paper and make a print of each table. And what came out were these really incredible images that were mediated through this medium of ink. So it had a kind of a, it was like nature in a certain way, but you could also see human impulse very strongly in it. You could see the quality of the gestures, the proximity, the distance, how often it happened, how much it happened. And you could get a sense of the dialogue through the simple traces on the table. And what this became was this idea of stepping back enough to be able to see a thing at a new distance or a new angle. And this provided a final step back. So right after the dialogue, we whipped those things off, made those prints, and laid them out on the ground. So we had 25 images on the ground. And then after all of these events, I have food and drink for the participants. And here people walked through these paintings and talked together and looked at them and used them as contemplative objects and objects, ways to think about what had just happened to them. So they became, this visual image became a new translation of their experience, which people reported was really valuable for them.
So as you go through this, There's tone and tenor in the room. There's changes, obviously, that people can see and feel through their movement and visually and with music integrated. Tell me about how you came then to, as a performance artist, the conflict aspect of your career, because you've authored a book, Changing the Conversation, the 17 Principles of Conflict Resolution. So for you, where did conflict resolution come to fit in?
Well, I guess about 10 years ago, and probably for the same reasons that many people do, I think I just got very sick of my own inability to handle the conflicts in my life in the different areas. And I was introduced into some new ideas about ways to maybe, you know, find a new mindset and a new approach. And I got more and more excited the more I saw how much transformation was possible in my relationships and in my life and in my family, my workplace. And for me, initially, the two things were separate. Other than that, the conflict training helps me, of course, in all the different areas of my life. So it wasn't until later that I started to see, you know, what in retrospect are kind of obvious parallels, which is that as a performing artist, one of the main practices is the capacity to see a situation new each time, because nothing ever stays the same. And you need to be able to navigate through whatever's going on to create a line that it's possible for the audience to follow. And which is what a mediator does, is ride through the complexities and the confusions of conflict in such a way that it helps the other people see where they are, see what might be possible, and understand what might help them to get where they want to go. So I think there's a similar kind of practice that goes on in the two fields, although initially that I just went there out of desperation, I think.
And so I'm thinking then about a conflict resolution practitioner now, a mediator, a conflict coach, a community worker, people engaged daily in aspects of conflict and helping to manage and resolve it. What do you think that a practitioner can take away from movement and the resolution of conflict in the way that you've described? How can those elements be integrated into daily practice where people can think about their thinking in the way you've described by participants coming to trainings with and having that lived experience of change in their thinking through the visual, through the movement? How can a practitioner use those tools, say daily or in some different integrative way, that will assist them in being able to manage and resolve conflict perhaps more efficiently, effectively, responsively?
Well, I was
is
just
there
thinking
a translation
about when I first...
to daily work?
Yeah, exactly. I was just thinking about when I first started training, and I was in a role-playing thing, and two of the women who were my teachers were mediating. And I was just amazed. I was like, this is like magic. This is like the best theater ever. Who are these women? How do they know how to do this? And, you know, over time, I began to see that there are huge parallels between theater and mediation. Because what the theater does is it allows people, it helps to helps the audience to be to come into a position where it's possible for them to see differently, and which is of course the same work that a mediator does. And so I think if we think about what we're already doing, because we're already making decisions in all of these areas, And maybe some of them can be more conscious in terms of what is the framework? What's the literal frame? Like if you think if you go to the theater, you oftentimes in a proscenium stage, you look at it in a literal frame. And so it's physically offered to you in a certain way. It's given to you temporally in terms of rhythm and in terms of the what you hear. So the idea of the physicality is less for me, in fact, really not at all for me about, you know, let's try to integrate movement into conflict resolution, but rather, okay, well, let's look and realize that conflict is already choreographic. It's already happening. We're already in systems where decisions have been made about how people are in relationship to each other physically, what's allowed, what's not allowed, what kind of movement we're offering to them, we're proposing as a way for to help them think differently, and to recognize that what is right now is already a choice, and that we have the opportunity to choose differently. And I think that for me, it's very important to not create kind of a formulaic idea about what might be useful, because I'm actually really curious what other practitioners would come up with if we say, okay, so here's some of the basic elements. One is the idea of creating physical equivalencies. So, for example, you can say, okay, when I do this, it means yes or no. There can be simple physical ways that make it easier for people to respond on a bare basic kind of yes-no level. There can be elements where you use placements in the room to help people get a sense of where they stand on issues or how what the fit situation feels like to each person in the room, depending, of course, on the character of the people that you're working with, what they feel comfortable doing. What I'm often interested in is, what about the people who would be like, don't give me any crap with, you know, movement or whatever. In that situation, what is the choreographic choice that would open up the situation even more? Because I don't ultimately care whether or not we use movement, but I just recognize how effective it is. So it would be a shame to throw it out as a tool. And so I think coming back to this question of saying, okay, where are we right now? What's literally happening in the room physically? What decisions have I made that are affecting that physicality? What decisions are the parties making? What other options are there? And might those options open the situation up more? And then I would love it if people would write to me and tell me what they find out. I think we need to investigate this together.
Well, and I think that the more we can all work together, the more enriching will be our own profession and our own practices. And within that, then take me back to the third model, the violence recode, because you're doing that internationally in different countries. You're looking at conflict, presumably engaging nations, communities. How do you then take such what seems to me a large challenge and bring it down to where it can be manageable and you can speak about international challenges in a certain place in a different way?
Well, I think it's kind of like in the way that this terrible picture of the drowned child, the Syrian refugee, helps people suddenly understand the nature of the overall problem. It's the same thing. It's in the individual experience that we're capable of accessing the larger issue, the larger structure, and of entering into it and saying, okay, I from this position, I feel the nature of the mechanism. So back to Paul Farmer's question, what is the mechanism by which these systems become embodied in our own individual experience? Because that's what I'm very interested in. That's in my book, was my kind of my focus as well, is what power does the individual have to affect concrete beneficial change no matter what the other people do. And so in these huge, you know, obviously in an event in one evening, we're not going to substantially impact racism worldwide. But what we can do is come to recognize how racism might have, for example, kind of gotten into our bodies in terms of what we feel is acceptable or normal, or even if we're not conscious of it, and what feels slightly uncomfortable. And bringing these things to awareness is part of the beginning of change, because when we start to recognize this is not acceptable, this is common, but it's not acceptable, and then we can start to think about, okay, what would make it possible to change? Another thing is, I was listening to a diversity trainer who was speaking of how subconscious bias, for example, racism, is very deeply embedded in our experience, and even when we're consciously attempting not to be racist, and that one of the things that diminishes that kind of bias is seeing, for example, an image of a successful or powerful black person, that diminishes unconscious bias. And so by using the body, having a physical experience, and also seeing the other people in the room move between different people in different situations according to these postures and these statements that come up, it's also a way for us to run up against these biases, to shake them a little bit and have a cognitive dissonance that allows us to become more conscious of their shape.
And just before, in the time we have left, I ask you for some final thoughts. I'm interested in what you just said, because it seems to me that when we affect change, we want to work towards affecting change. As we're doing work as conflict managers and resolvers,
mm-hmm.
it must be then even more vital that we understand that we may have biases that are even subconscious or have some way become part of us, even though intellectually
mm-hmm.
There's a different approach. How do you reconcile those two then?
The fact that we're flawed moving into these discussions, you mean?
Yes, and
that
you used the example of racism. So
yeah.
Intellectually, people can address, it seems to me, racism on one level, but how do you get then that if people have grown up perhaps with other messages and they're working to change those or overcome those, but as you said, it might be subconscious, then
yeah.
How do you bring those to the surface so people can look at those things in a way that can be informative, concrete,
mm-hmm.
Part of a change exploration, and not feel shame around those things, because
yeah.
sometimes those feelings can come into play as well. What would you say about that?
Yeah, and that's the big challenge for me with this project, is to take the shame out of the equation and say, you know, rather than who's wrong in this room right now, how do we look at this overall issue? And it's interesting, because one of the postures that tends to be the most controversial is one that I heard a diversity trainer talking about. She's a professional diversity trainer, and she found herself on a plane. Unfortunately, I don't remember her name. She had a TED Talk. She found herself on a plane, and the pilot came on, and it was a woman. And she said, all right, there's women pilots, great. And then they took off, and the storm came. And she found herself thinking, oh, I hope this woman knows how to fly. And this sexist thought in her brain, she said, I can't believe I just thought that. How can I think a sexist thought? But these things are so deep. And so it's sometimes in that running up against this feeling of like, oh, my God, I can't believe I just thought that, that you start to uncover it and make it visible so that it can change. And that's part of what this project does, is by giving these simple postures and giving these simple statements, it puts people physically in a position where they often encounter, because you do feel it stronger when it's happening in your body, they do encounter where they feel a little bit uncomfortable or where they feel really uncomfortable. And running into it physically without having to be in a big conversation about it, it's simply an internal process, even though everyone in the room is going through it at the same time, is the kind of step that I understand helps us to not only see maybe where we're holding these biases, but to recognize it as an overarching pattern that if it got us, you know, it's probably gotten a lot of other people as well. But it doesn't mean that we're doomed, and which is really important to me. We're not doomed to our biases. We can be conscious of them. We can actively change them by recognizing the opposites, you know, recognizing a powerful black person, recognizing a powerful woman, recognizing the elements, the powerful elements in all groups of society, in white people, in gay people, in black people, in Hispanic people, and to change what we focus on. And I think that focus on the power and the possibility for change within different parts of society, different groups, is what's exciting to me.
Dana, as we come to the close of our interview, any final thoughts about collaboration, working together locally, nationally, internationally? Is it different in Germany than in other international communities or in your own home country? How do you level all of those things and bring it down to people with people?
Mm. Well, I find that what changes is the way, for example, in this current project, Violence Recode, what changes is the way that the violence systems manifest, so the stories are different. But ultimately, the structures and the systems are the same. And the people, everybody that I work with worldwide is people, you know, and everybody essentially wants the same thing. They want to connect. They want to belong. They want to offer meaningful contribution. They want to feel valued. And those, because those underlying human needs are always present, powers these conversations. And so what's really interesting to me is have the chance to work with all these different people and to say, okay, I see the structure of my structure, my choreographic strategy needs to change here, because the system's changed here. And because I, of course, don't know, I'm like a channel for ideas to move through. Because the people where I go, they know what's happening there. They know what's needed, what's difficult. And so my honor and my challenge is to try to figure out tools and instruments that will help them make visible what they need to bring to light.
Dana, I want to thank you. This has been a most interesting conversation. I want to thank you for taking the time to speak with me today.
And, oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
And my guest again, Dana Casperson, an award-winning performance artist and conflict specialist working in arts-based conflict practices in all the way that she's described during this conversation. And look for Dana's article on choreographic public dialogue, Visible Thought, in the spring edition of ACR Resolution magazine. Thank you again, Dana.
Thank you so much.